You may proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Richard Student. I represent the appellant, Nancy Devine. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
This particular case comes to you all as a result of the sale of this old 203-year-old house. And you all have already heard this in the prior record, so I'm not going to go over it. But on behalf of the appellant, Nancy Devine, we actually had a finding by the court, the lower court, that Mrs. Devine had done absolutely nothing wrong. And I quote to you from the judge's letter ruling, which is found on page 18 of the appellant's brief, my brief. The problem is the commissioner makes no findings about Mrs. Devine individually, nor in his report does he attribute fraud, misrepresentation, or concealment to her. In that particular case, this particular case, I think the inquiry should have ended there. It is sort of the bedrock notion of American jurisprudence, and certainly in Virginia jurisprudence, that you must first find that a plaintiff has been harmed by a defendant before you can then begin to fashion a remedy. In this particular case, the appellee was asking for rescission. The judge ordered it. Despite the fact that the judge found Mrs. Devine had done absolutely nothing wrong, the court ordered rescission, ordered interest on two deeds of trust, and interest on top of that interest, which is the subject of something else. I jumped ahead. I really would just like to discuss all the first three assignments of error together, if I might, in order to be brief for the court, and I think that they all work together anyway. I've cited Bacon versus the City of Richmond. And that's an ADA compliance case. It's not fact-specific here, but it really does set out the rule of law very, very clearly for us. In that case, the court quoted, "Our legal system is built upon the fundamental principle that remedies are a means of redressing wrongs. Remedies do not exist in the abstract. Rather, they flow from and are the consequence of some wrong. At its most basic, this principle limits the reach of judicial decrees to parties found liable for legal violation." And that's why I'm here. Mrs. Devine was not found guilty of a violation of anything. And the court specifically found that. At that point, the case ends with regard to Mrs. Devine, and whatever happens to the other party in that case is that's that case.
As a practical matter, case N says to Mrs. Devine, rescission is awarded as to Mr. Devine. How does that situation resolve itself?
You can't do it, Your Honor. You can't do it. If both parties own property, it's tenants by the entirety, and you find that one has engaged in egregious conduct which amounts to fraud, but the other party has not, you just can't do it. Rescission is an extraordinary remedy. You have to plead it with particularity, and you have to prove it by clear and convincing evidence against both parties. The most fact-specific case I could find with regard to that was First v. Williams. And if you look at that case, the appellee's done a really good job of sort of convoluting or confusing that case. But here's what that case stands for. In that case, Mr. Hurst borrowed money from a lender, and he got his wife, Mrs. Hurst, to pledge property as collateral for the note. Mr. Hurst told the lender that the property was free and clear of all liens. The lender then found out it was not. He also found out that Mrs. Hurst had a lot of other property that was free and clear of all liens. So he sued to rescind. In that particular case, this court said, you can go after Mr. Hurst because he is guilty of fraud, but you cannot against Mrs. Hurst because she did nothing wrong. Now, we're not going to rescind the deed of trust on the property that Mrs. Hurst voluntarily and of her own volition signed over to the lender because she did do that voluntarily. But we're not going to let you attach her other property that is not a lien. And that is the best case that I could find. And it stands for the proposition that you have to prove your case against both parties. And at the end of the day, when you boil this thing down, in a nutshell, the appellee failed to prove his case against Mrs. Devine. And it really is that simple. With regard to the issue of prejudgment interest, it's our position that court never should have gotten there because the case should have been dismissed with regard to Mrs. Devine the minute there was a finding that she did nothing wrong. But if you go beyond that, the idea of rescission is to put them back to the status quo. And so in that particular case, the court ordered $590,000 repayment of the purchase price. Interest on two deeds of trust, because you all know that was a time when the market was crazy and people could borrow, get two deeds of trust on one piece of property. So it was interest on that. But then the court ordered interest on top of that interest. And that amounts to a windfall for the plaintiff in this case, and it just should not have been awarded.
Is it possible to have rescission in this case without any requirements against your client to pay any damages? In other words, the deed goes back, but any obligations that result because of the fraud would be assessed against the husband and not the wife. Is that possible?
The judge actually found that because she had done nothing wrong, he was not going to award consequential damages or attorney's fees, but then went on to the rescission. No, I don't think you can order rescission against a party who has been found innocent of any wrongdoing.
But, well, perhaps. You may be right. I've just never seen the case. They would be getting the deed back, right, from the buyer.
They would be receiving the property back.
And so she receives the property back. If she doesn't have to pay anything, could you actually have rescission nonetheless with the disgorgement of all of the money to the buyers allocated to the husband because he's the one who was guilty of fraud? Is that possible?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is.
And why not?
Because she's an innocent party. And it goes back...
But she's getting it.
Getting what?
She's getting the property.
She's getting her house back.
Yeah, she's getting the house back. Could you have rescission that gives her the house back but puts the burden of all the monetary damages on the husband, who is the one who was found guilty of fraud?
Court has absolutely no authority to order any remedy against any party who has not been found liable or guilty of a wrongdoing.
Counsel,
that's the problem.
Counsel, there's actually a line of equitable cases that all stand for the following proposition, that when Party A has done a wrong, that has injured Party B, and Party A has been allowed to do, enabled to do the wrong because of some act or omission of Party C, that Party C also must bear an equitable consequence. That outlines what one could argue you have here. Mr. Devine is Party A. He allegedly committed a wrong. That's, the court has found that he did. Party B is Dookie and Marshall, who did no wrong. Party C is Ms. Devine, who has been found not to have done a wrong, but who, by signing the deed, by remaining silent, enabled Mr. Devine to carry out his fraud. Now, the cases aren't cited in the briefs, but take me at my word, there's a line of cases that stand for that proposition, inequity. You have the opportunity to respond about whether that ought to or ought not to guide a decision by the court in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I guess what I would say is you said an act or omission. And what I would take from an act or omission is a finding that they, with regard to an act, that they did something either by participating in or furthering the fraud of the other party. Or with omission, they knew, had knowledge, sort of tacitly approved, and had an obligation to act, and did. But I can find no... And so I see that. I see that. In fact, appellant cites a Michigan case and a Pennsylvania case for the proposition that you can do what the judge did. But in one of those cases, there was an act by the wife. The court found, and I believe it was a Michigan case, and I apologize for not being sure, that there was an act by the wife in furtherance of the fraud. And in the Pennsylvania case, I believe, they found she at least had knowledge and sort of tacitly approved and omitted from doing anything to stop it. In all cases in Virginia, and I would tell you in American jurisprudence, period, equity has broad discretion to fashion remedies, if you can get to the equity side of the court, and rightly so. They have great discretion to fashion remedies to fix harms. But there's always one condition precedent, and that one condition precedent is finding that defendant did something wrong, either willfully or negligently, but did something wrong, and that wrong needs to be redressed.
In the line of cases cited by Justice Mims, could the wife signing the contract, could that be an act?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. There has to be some wrongdoing. Courts do not take cognizance of a case and fashion remedies when the party's done nothing wrong. I mean, that's not what courts do. They fix wrongdoings by people. But when you have an innocent party, you cannot fashion a remedy against that individual.
How's the remedy against her? Okay, that's the dilemma. I mean, I understand you keep using that phrase, but as Justice Mims points out, I mean, she's in the transaction. The rescission is clearly proper against the husband if he were the only party. Why is this a remedy against her if she's getting the asset back but has no obligation to pay any of the money to the buyer? Why is it against her?
I'm going to answer this a difficult way. How in the world could we ever do business in Virginia if we thought that we could have a transaction and I have done absolutely nothing wrong in that transaction, yet a court can come back and undo that transaction with me as an innocent party? It is the sense of finality. The jurisdiction of the court goes to the one who has injured someone else. And that's the best way I can answer it.
Well, but you keep talking about damage to her. She's getting the property back without having to pay anything.
She may not want the property.
Would that be because the sale
is forced upon her? And you're right, I'm not so sure I would agree that rescission was clear as a husband either. One of the interesting things about this, and I've learned a lot, I don't know as much about any of this as you all do, but here's a case where we had two home inspections. Both inspectors gave warnings about the structural integrity, and even one inspector said you better get this evaluated by a contractor because the sill is deteriorated on the inside.
This they were talking about is not what was under the siding. You have to.
No, there is no
way you can read this.
I can tell you a little bit about this. I've got an office in rural Westmoreland County that is about 130 years old, and it's this post and beam construction. And all you have with post and beam construction, some cases you've got a few cinder blocks where a beam sits on top of it, other times you have bricks where a wooden beam sits on top of it. There's only one sill in that house, and it goes all the way around the house. So the basement comes up with the masonry. Then you just have a wooden piece. Then you put termite shields, you know, the aluminum things on them. It just didn't happen back then. And invariably, those sills get eaten up. It's bound to happen, and they have to be replaced. I had to replace it in mine. It is only one sill. They're not multiple sills, and it goes all the way around. It was the same sill they saw that was eaten up with termites from the inside. Just not as bad as it was on the outside.
Not nearly.
Not as bad. I'm going to reserve the rest of the time if I may.
All right, you have 30 seconds to me.
Well, not only did the two inspectors employed by my clients say there's nothing wrong with this house that would keep you from buying it, Bill Knight, who is the not only a certified inspector, but even I think for 30 years the building inspector for Northumberland County, said he went all the way around and sounded it, and it was fine. And then the defendants had two inspectors who testified at trial look at it, and both of those guys agreed you could not tell from inside the basement that there was anything wrong with the sill. The only way you could tell was to tear off the siding. To the main issue here. We don't quarrel with the holding in Bacon. That was where the court found that the city of Richmond violated the ADA, and there was no evidence of a violation. So you have one defendant, no evidence that defendant did anything wrong, and therefore the finding against that defendant was set aside. Hearst is a different matter. In Hearst, the trial court rescinded the transaction, including the deed of trust given by the wife. And on appeal, the court said that if the trial court had not found the wife guilty of fraud as it should have, the prayer for rescission would have been denied as ineffective since it would, in effect, make recovery by the plaintiff more difficult. In other words, if the deed of trust is rescinded, the plaintiff can't enforce the deed of trust to make himself whole for this obligation. But if the deed of trust is not rescinded, then the plaintiff gets to enforce the deed of trust. And if that is not sufficient to make him whole financially, then he can go after the husband for the deficiency. So when the court sent it back, the court said, enter such decrees regarding the deed of trust as best addresses the plaintiff's equities. In other words, the court said, trial court, don't rescind the deed of trust. This plaintiff, whose equities are under consideration, is going to be better off if you don't. Now, this is the wife's deed of trust. She may have had reasons she would like to have it rescinded. She may have had reasons she wouldn't have wanted it rescinded. But she is before the court, even though the court has found, no, you weren't guilty of any fraud. Her interests are still subject to the decree of the chancellor.
Because she secured the property.
Yes.
Her interest is before the court because she was the security on the property. Mrs. Marshall, or Mrs. Devine, has done nothing other than sign a contract to sell a house. How did the two equate?
I think signing a contract to sell the house and joining in that transaction, I think it's equivalent to providing a deed of trust. You're a part of the transaction. You're before the court. Your interests, under those circumstances, are subject to the decree of the chancellor. I think they're the same. They have argued that, and I don't think they've argued here today, but it's in the briefs, that a finding where you sue for rescission and you find as to one party that there was a defrauding, but as to the other there wasn't, that somehow the court loses equity jurisdiction. Well, the court couldn't have done what the court did in Hearst if that were true. They argue in the brief that Mrs. Devine has been ordered to pay this money back simply because she is married to Mr. Devine. Well, that isn't the situation at all. As you very clearly noted, she gets the property back in rescission. She is merely being required to participate to restore the status quo, which is the hallmark of rescission. Now, the cases from outside Virginia, I will agree, they are not factually on all fours. When you've got a factually complex case, you hardly ever find a case that's factually on all fours. But the theme is the same through those cases. Despite the fact that one of the two parties, husband and wife, didn't participate in the fraud, the non-defrauding spouse has to join in rescission in conveying the property back. Or rather paying the consideration back and receiving the property. Now, the motion for consideration, the way this worked, that the court, they filed exceptions to the commissioner's report, and we briefed it, and then the court heard argument, and there was some delay, but the court ultimately ruled at that point that we were entitled to rescission, and that although Ms. Devine wasn't guilty of any fraud, she had to join in paying back the purchase price and taking the property back. Now, that was roughly 17 months ago, and I can assure you that my opponent has combed the cases, not just of this Commonwealth, but coast to coast, as we have, to find a case that says you can't do it, to find a case that says under these circumstances you cannot order the wife to join in refunding the purchase price. We haven't found one. They haven't found one. I submit there isn't one out there, because that is an appropriate remedy.
How is that different than a judgment lien and a creditor? In a tenancy by the entireties, her interest wouldn't be subject to a judgment lien creditor, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so what you just described, how is that different? I'm having trouble understanding the difference.
Well, the order which directs that money be paid by statute becomes a judgment. And as to the purchase money that's supposed to be refunded, if it isn't, it can be collected as a judgment. And under those circumstances, then jointly owned property would be subject, just as any other asset would be subject to collection efforts. That's true.
But you'd be getting a judgment against her when the commissioner said she'd done nothing wrong, wouldn't
no.
you?
No. The statute regarding the definition of judgment, I don't have the statute before me, but it says an order that requires the payment of money shall be deemed a judgment, and it's enforceable as a judgment. It's in the section that has to do with collecting judgments. And so of course that has to be so. Otherwise, if you've got an order that says you've got to refund this purchase price and it isn't done, how else could you possibly enforce it?
But you're still enforcing it against the wife who did nothing wrong.
Exactly. You would be. There's no other way to collect it. Agreed? The interest issue. As I was preparing for this, I realized, and counsel can answer this, that the interest issue was not raised below as required by 5:25. It wasn't in the exceptions. It wasn't in the brief in support of the exceptions. It wasn't an oral argument regarding the exceptions. It wasn't mentioned in the court's ruling on exceptions. It wasn't raised in the motion to reconsider. Or argued on reconsideration, and what ruled upon in the court's final opinion regarding reconsideration on August 23 of 13. So I submit to the court that the interest issue was not raised below. But in any event,
counsel, I think you already answered this question, but let me ask it again. If rescission against the wife is not the appropriate remedy, is your damage claim still alive?
Yes.
If we remand it as it is?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why? How? How is your damage claim alive? You elected rescission rather than compensatory damages. You dropped that claim.
Let me make sure I understand the question. If you rule that rescission is not the appropriate remedy because
Correct.
The wife didn't commit any wrong...
Is it reverse final judgment, or is it reverse and the court still has the ability to consider your damage claim?
I think it's reversed and sent back.
And the question from Justice Lacey is how or why?
Well...
You withdrew your legal claim. You elected to go with the rescission claim. So now do you get to go back and... say, well, now I want to do my legal claim?
Well, I think certainly we'd be entitled to, and I think at the very least, as Justice Lemon suggested, if that's the court's opinion, then the appropriate remedy would be to say, okay, you're entitled to rescission, but you got to get the purchase price on the husband. And he, of course, under those circumstances, would remain liable for the consequential damages.
But that's not what I think Justice Powell was asking. Maybe I'm wrong.
Counsel, let me... four in on the verb you used. Did you withdraw the claim, meaning that the claim is no longer before the court, or did you make an election as you were approaching trial saying, Judge, we will move forward on rescission, we will not move forward on damages? How is it stopped? How is it pending, or is it pending within the jurisdiction of the court?
We made an election. We didn't withdraw.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure what the answer to this question is, but if it is an election, the underlying premise behind all these questions is it stopped by res judicata? So that's the issue. And at least so you know that that's what's at stake. Do you have anything else you'd like to add to how we ought to deal with the remedy if we find rescission is not proper?
I think it should be set back for damages.
Well, I understand that, and I guess we'll await the pleading for that it could have been brought. It was withdrawn. As a result, it's res judicata. That's what you might face. I'm not opining as to whether that's right or it's wrong, but I think at the heart of these questions is the question of whether or not it is still alive.
It seems that you made an election that if we... We're electing rescission if we win, and if we don't, we'll come back and do our legal, go through the legal evidentiary requirements to establish damages.
Yes. Any other question?
Thank you for your argument. You have 30 seconds.
All right. Your Honor, I just would like to leave you all with one thought.
What's your response to the questions we were just asking? The opposing counsel.
With regard to remedy?
If the court decided that rescission was not the appropriate remedy, I know your answer would be as to my client, it's over anyway, but what would be the remedy? Is the election now placing them in final judgment?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I think you have to choose which course you're going, and I don't think you can, if you proceed to go rescission under the equity jurisdiction of the court, which is sort of the whole hog, you've made that election. And if you don't, I think you're stuck. If they had gone under a breach of contract claim...
But they did. I mean, their complaint has that. Also, it has additional counts that have to do with breach of contract.
And they let it go.
They let it go. What do you mean, let it go?
Well, they chose not to try to prove that.
But doesn't the court have to, like, dismiss it or something? I mean, I think that's where everybody's trying to get to. It's like we talk about election, abandonment, but you don't see any mention in the order one way or another as to what happened to these causes of action that were in the complaint.
I didn't try the case below, Your Honor. I came in it late. But it would appear to me that once you choose to proceed down that one path and put your evidence on for that, that's where you're stuck.
Well, one thing is clear. That issue is not before us now, and none of our musings on the subject should be taken as a decision one way or the other whether this case goes back or not.
May I finish my one thought that I was going to offer?
As long as it's really short.
Really quick. Your Honor, we talk about an innocent party, and you ask me why I said it was against her. The one thought I want to leave you all with is the court has entered judgment against my client for nearly $900,000. That's why I say it's against her. And they are levying her bank accounts. They levied her daughter's bank account, of which my client was the custodian of, for her little summer paycheck. That is a real issue. She is not an innocent party who just joins in by signing the contract. She now has a $900,000 judgment against her. And that's wrong, and that's why we're here asking you to fix it. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.